Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 214 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, Eleanor Dimott speaks with Robin Blake about storytelling's essential role in the British legal system, migrating from law journalism to fiction, and the childhood origins of an unsettling recurrent theme in her writing.
Eleanor Dimott converted from a career as a lawyer to that of a writer, first as a legal journalist for The Times, and then a crime writer with her first novel, Every Contact Leaves a Trace, about a death at an Oxford college. Her second novel, Silver and Salt, is the story of a grieving family told in a distinctive elegiac style and voice. Both novels show off Eleanor's ability to construct a compelling non-linear story in which time folds and doubles back before revealing its narrative secrets. Eleanor is tremendously well-travelled. She was born in Zambia and brought up in the United States, the UK and Indonesia.
I mean, a lot of people who might be listening to this will want to know how people became writers. Mm. Can you tell us about how that happened in your case?
Yeah, I sometimes think back to when did I write the first piece of fiction. I do remember English at school every now and again being asked to write a scene. It was very scene-based, and it was therefore very achievable for a child to describe one thing that happened and one situation. And I remember one... I think I remember the first thing I made up being a story of being on a walk in the Lake District. My family used to go to the Lake District on holiday quite a lot. My dad was a climber in his early life. And I think the first scene I wrote was about walking through a hilly landscape and being lost and the wind whistling. And I think because of the restriction on that piece, you know, it was short and I was young, and it presented itself as a ready-made scene. So then there came the idea of writing scenes, which I just, that's how I kind of think of writing. And then I think the next thing I wrote fiction was at university. I wrote a fairy tale. I read, so for me writing and reading are kind of inextricable, and reading is almost the same as writing. So I read obsessively as a child and through my teens and then read English at university, and writing just came out of that. It was kind of almost as though all the time I was reading, I was writing, and then it was just a question of when. So then I did English at university, wrote essays, wanted to be a singer. That didn't work out, and quite swiftly, kind of overnight, became a lawyer instead, and quite swiftly realised that wasn't what I wanted to do. But being a lawyer is all about telling stories and working out stories and comparing different versions of the same story and deciding which one can stand up or be shot down. That's effectively all I think that law is about, is competing versions of the same story. Who tells the best story wins, kind of thing. And after a few years in practice, then I switched to reporting the law in the Royal Courts of Justice for The Times and various different series of law reports, including the law reports. And that was then a period of 10 years when that was what I did all day, every day, listening to competing versions of stories, hearing which one was going to be chosen as the story, and then being given a very, very short space in which to summarise it. So the practice I developed then was construing a story or taking the elements of a story from a huge mass of information and presenting it in a way that, I mean, the Times Law Reports is supposed to be for the lay reader. You're supposed to be able to read it over your breakfast and understand it. Space in the newspaper has been reduced, but they are still there, and they are the reports that are allowed to be cited in court.
So you find that quite a good training?
Well, it's exciting in a way. I mean, first of all, it was terrifying being given a day to reduce a 600-page judgment to 500 words. Felt kind of nutty, actually, the idea that you could do that reliably. But then being given my editor sent me off to do my first Times Law Report. When I went to hand it in, I also gave him the judgment, and he said, "Why are you giving me that?" And I said, "Well, so you can check whether I got it right." And he said, "No, no, 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 I don't read that. That's your job." And I said, well, how are you going to know? What if I misconstrued the law? And he said, I'll have a phone call from the judge in the morning if there's anything wrong when it gets published. So
no pressure then.
It was amazing. It was just the most amazing, first of all, terrifying, but then this incredible license of trust, really, trust. So you do that job as a qualified lawyer. So the assumption is you can understand enough about it to be able to reduce it in such a way that nothing important is left out. The point of law is expressed succinctly but correctly, and I think that's what then gave me actually the confidence to write more confidence about writing fiction. It's the idea of being told I could tell a story.
Your first novel, or perhaps your first published novel, is Every Contact Leaves a Trace, and that has, I think, that leaves the impression of some of your experience as a law reporter, because it has a lot of interleaved accounts of the same events from different points of view, and the narrator is a lawyer, in fact, isn't it?
Yes, so finally there was something worth having struggled through law school. I got a novel out of it. It seemed to fit his character very well, Alex Peterson, that he's a solicitor rather than a barrister. So his best friend in the novel, Richard, is a barrister, and they are kind of opposite sides of a coin in terms of how they behave socially and emotionally. So Richard, the barrister, is ebullient and argumentative and confident and sort of gets on with his life and forms relationships and is successful and has children. Alex Peterson, the solicitor, he stands back and watches and he's very much an observer. So in the English legal system, you have in court, you see the barristers at the front standing up and doing their thing, and then behind them are these studious solicitors with files of papers who are just preparing and analysing and sifting information, which is very much Alex's character.
That's the top layer of a complex story, which is about the past. It starts in problems in childhood, but it's really a university novel, isn't it? And one of the great pleasures for me in reading it was my enjoyment of those kind of university novels, which kind of take the reader back, if they're lucky enough to have been to university, to those strange, innocent, dangerous years.
Yes.
Did you enjoy, I mean, was that part of your impulse, because you wanted to revisit those years?
Well, they make such a big impression if you, as you say, are lucky enough to study at a university. But obviously it's also a time when a whole lot of other stuff is going on in most people's lives, which is to do with leaving home if they had one, growing up, working out how to be in a strange place, in a new environment, and work in a different way and read in a different way. Reading English at university is really wonderful. It struck me as the most incredible boon to be able to basically sit around reading novels. It was dreamy. Effectively, it was just an extension of what I'd always done, which was reading books. But then I had conversations about them, and sometimes then wrote those conversations down. It seemed too good to be true. Was that why I wanted to write it? It came out of a visit one summer night back to the college I'd studied at, and standing by the lake with the person I was with, and looking out across the lake, and it was quite a sudden thing. I just thought, yeah, this has got to be a place to tell a story.
Did you want it to be a murder story? Because it is a murder story, isn't it, at the bottom? But it's an awful lot more than that. But that's the beginning, and that's what all the conversations and events which you relate circle around, isn't it?
Yes. I'd written quite a lot of short fiction by the time I wrote this novel. And I had a conversation with an editor of mine at the Law Reports who was very kindly regularly giving me feedback on my short fiction, and we would talk about writing and how to go about it. He's a writer himself and had published a literary magazine, and so he's given me lots of kind of input. And he'd read a number of my short stories and said, he made an observation which hadn't occurred to me but probably should have done, each of them featured the death of a small animal. And he said, why don't you write, if you're going to write a novel, which I really wanted to do, why don't you kind of max it up a bit and write about the death of a human rather than the death of a gerbil or I think I have a rat in one of them. And so he suggested I write one about a person being killed. And not that that's why I wrote the book, but it was a kind of a, oh, okay. Plus, I was really, really hooked on murder mysteries, reading them, watching them on TV, mainly watching them on TV, Poirot, Morse, which I kind of grew up with. I had a brother who died when I was, when he was very young, just before I was born, and it kind of defined my childhood, this idea of, and I was never really told, well, until very recently, what happened to him. And if you can think of a narrative that defines a life, that was a narrative that defined mine, was this kind of sense of mystery surrounding a loss that I struggled with and still struggle with. That was, I think, why I wrote Every Contact Leaves a Trace, or at least inspired by that kind of idea that I think everyone carries those kind of unexplained or unresolved losses, and literature is both reading it and I find writing it a great way of working that kind of stuff out.
Sometimes you're not sure whether you're talking about a mystery which is there because somebody's protecting you from the truth, or a mystery that's there for some other reason.
Ah, so there's one scene in Every Contact Leaves a Trace when Alex Peterson, as a schoolboy, is trying to get into university to study law, and the tutor who's interviewing him asks him to define a white lie. And I actually was asked that question when there was a point when I'd finished my English degree and I was making the transition to law, and I was considering, rather than going to law school and doing the really quick, rapid requalification, I was considering doing a law degree. If I had been able to get funding, I might have done. And I spoke to a law professor about the course, and he was kind of trying me out and just working out whether he could take me onto his course. And he asked me that question, tell me, define a white lie. It was a really interesting idea. What is a white lie? A lie that people tell. One way of defining it would be to say a lie that is told to protect somebody, that by not telling someone the truth, you can make them happier or prevent them from being sad. And I'm sure a lot of my parents' motivation in not talking about what happened, well, it was for lots of different reasons. One of them was probably a kind of preservation thing or a protection thing. So Alex struggles through the novel with a lot of people not telling him things about his deceased wife that they think he might be better off not knowing, whereas ultimately he wants to know.
In the story that you suggested I read before this interview, which is based on a Greek myth, and why did you want me to read that, and why did you think that would be a useful pointer to some of your own interests as a writer?
So the story I suggested to you is a story called Henry and Boo Boo, which was published in an American anthology of stories, all of which retell myths, called X.O. Orpheus, edited by Kate Bernheimer for Penguin in the USA. And it takes a whole bunch of writers who get the opportunity to retell a myth, any myth. There are plenty in there that I'd come across and plenty I hadn't. And I think it says pretty much everything there is to say for me about storytelling, that a story is only ever a retelling of another story. All the good stories are retelling other stories. And the time that I was asked to write the story Henry and Boo Boo coincided with a time when I was really interested in myth for that reason. There was an exhibition on in London at the National Gallery about myth, and it had the same myth running through the exhibition, but told through a ballet, told through a painting, told through... Well, it's wonderful that stories can exist in so many different ways. And my story, Henry and Boo Boo, was... I guess another reason I suggested it was that it says a lot about my writing in the process of how I wrote it. I chose a story, Candaules and Gyges, which is in the histories of Herodotus, which I'd heard for the first time when reading The English Patient by Michael Ondaatje and Catherine Clifton. She sits down one night in the desert by the fireside with a whole bunch of people sitting around listening, and she reads the story of Candaules and Gyges from Herodotus to the group. And that story performs a really important part in The English Patient. And then a number of things happened in my life which meant I kept coming across that story at around the time that I was asked to write the myth.
I mean, the original myth is about a very adult piece of voyeurism, essentially, isn't it, and the repercussions of that. But there are also those classic elements of the love triangle in it as well, aren't there? And you transpose that in the story to childhood, so it's young children.
Yes. So the Candaules and Gyges myth is... It's an origins of dynasty myth, so it's how the new kingdom became formed, the kingdom of the Lydians, which had been there for 550 years, I think, Herodotus says. And the king, invites his bodyguard to stand behind an arras and watch his wife undress as a way of trying to prove to the bodyguard that he is married to the most beautiful woman in the world. And what's really amazing about the way Herodotus tells it is he hardly tells you anything. You get absolutely the most bare bones of this story. Really nothing is explained. There's no backstory. There's no characterization. There's no nothing. You just get told the facts. But you get a little tiny hint of how Gyges felt. Gyges, because he complains, he says, actually, I don't want to. I don't think I should. It's not right that I look at your wife. And the king says, no, it's fine. She won't notice and she won't know that you're there. There's all sorts of really fascinating things about the story. The queen isn't even given a name. We just know that she's the queen and these two guys are doing this thing. And Gyges says he objects and he doesn't want to do it, but he does it because he kind of says he has to. Does he really have to? I mean, novels now, we get all those questions answered. We get people exploring those reasons. This, the kind of appeal of the Herodotus was that it said very little, but it leaves this enormous room for opening up the story. And then it then got translated to a childhood story because at around the same time I was told a story by a musician I knew about something that had happened in his childhood, where two guinea pigs had died one summer afternoon that belonged to him and his little brother. And he had never told his mum what had actually happened. Never did. And that was an amazing story, that he had carried that with him his whole life and had never quite found a way of fessing up to what happened to his brother's guinea pigs. And
also plays into your fascination with stories about the deaths of small animals.
Yeah, which I only just realised I do have to do something about that. Yes, and it was so vivid the way he described it. He was a composer and a musician, and he was very passionate. And I just never forget the moment that he described that. Actually, what he described most vividly was having to pick them up and hold them in his hands, and that they had become entirely stiff. These animals that a few hours earlier had been playing, and that his brother and him had kind of been looking after. And it was literally just a chronological coincidence. I had this dinner with my friend, took place at around the same time as the Myths exhibition and around the same time as I went to York to see The Cunning Little Vixen, which is also about humans becoming animals and an animal death. And everything kind of just... all these things happened around the same month or 2 month period, and we're all kind of bubbling away and doing their own thing. And the story of Candaules and Gyges, then I was asked to write the myth retelling for the anthology, and then all those ideas started to crystallise. So then what I did was I sat down with the Herodotus and I drew up a list of, in a kind of law reporting way, what are the story elements that I'm working with? I sort of reduced it to a bare bones plot summary, effectively, but looked at what elements I would have to map in my story, in my retelling of a myth. And once that happened, then the story started being told, and then there had to be a voyeuristic act to match the voyeuristic act in Candaules and Gyges. So, and it did become, obviously, pretty disturbing and difficult. But I think childhood is, it's a difficult time.
You have a comparable situation in Every Contact, don't you? Where you have the three students getting drunk on vodka, two girls and a boy, and the sexual activities of the two girls. He's not allowed to take part, he can only watch. It's something comparable.
Yeah. I mean, again, so in Every Contact Leaves a Trace, I guess the plot came together in the same way. I was reading lots of things at the time that I was thinking of the novel, and I thought it would be great to have a poet involved who could sort of drive the plot. It would be great to have a poet whose poems could be used as actual kind of parts of the plot. And I chose Robert Browning because he himself had written a really long murder mystery poem, which took a story from real life that he'd come across in a bunch of old papers he'd found in a market in Florence, and written The Ring and the Book as a way of retelling that real life story. So then I started reading Robert Browning and finding some... his poems are really sexually fucked up. I mean, people strangle each other as a sex act and kind of... well, My Last Duchess. I mean, that is so... you can't really get much more messed up than that. This guy taking somebody through a gallery, showing somebody a painting of his wife who he's quite possibly murdered, and then kind of getting lost in a reverie of how she herself was, you know, the blush on her cheeks suggests some kind of sexual shame that he then punched her for with some horrendously violent, well, death. So what happened with Every Conflict Is Trace was then I started reading these Browning poems, and then they wove themselves into the story, and then it got more and more kind of... Plus, when I was writing Every Contact Leaves a Trace, I had published a few short stories, written lots of short stories, wanted to be a novelist, wanted to be a writer, wanted to get an agent, wanted to get a publisher, actually sat down and wrote a list of what kind of things I could put in a book that would make me most likely to get an agent and a publisher. Sex, voyeuristic sex, sells. I've been publishing in small literary magazines for £20 a time, or less. I wanted to move things on. I'd been writing a much, much longer novel, which I'd been writing for years, and I wasn't looking like finishing anytime soon. And I'd got sort of slightly lost in the middle about how to actually do it. I didn't really know how to do it. And I thought, okay, I'm just going to write something really quickly and try and write something which I think somebody will publish and somebody will maybe take me on as a writer, an agent, you know, might take me on. So it was a mixture of all those things. It was the Browning poetry, it was the visit back to college, seeing the lake and thinking this would be a great scene. It was being hooked on murder mysteries. It was still being really preoccupied with how my brother had died, why my brother had died. And then thinking, oh, I want to write a book which has things in which is going to get published. So I put the sex stuff in because it works, actually, and it did work.
Well, it's essential to it, actually. I wouldn't have said one should be cynical about your introduction of sex. I mean, sex is very, very important to people of the age you're writing about, 19, 20-year-olds, you know, and there are people for whom that happens. There's a very interesting discussion here because they're studying literature, or some of them are studying literature, and one of the main characters is a lecturer and teacher of literature at Oxford. Is this discussion about the role of coincidence in fiction?
Oh, yes.
And you also have described the coincidences which lead a writer very often to form a story in a particular way. It's the way in which a series of dice fall in front of you at any one moment and gives you a story or gives you the beginning of a story.
Yeah.
So is that what happened, for example, your most recent novel, published novel, is Silver and Salt? Did that come about in a similar sort of way? And does that have... the same reliance on coincidences which either drive the action or allow the mystery to be solved at the end?
Actually, yes, very much so. Silver and Salt did happen in that way as well. So going back a second to Every Contact, the coincidence discussion you picked up on in Every Contact Leaves a Trace comes towards the end of the novel and is in there for two reasons. One, I had a great difficulty persuading my original American editor that the ending of the book should stand. He decided in the end that it shouldn't, so I now have a different American publisher. But one of his great difficulties was that it hinged too much on coincidence. That editor felt that my book hinged too much
on coincidence. So did you write that scene deliberately to put him right?
Well, no, not to put him right, but actually it did start making me think about that question. Mm. And it's fascinating. Coincidence happens every day in real life. But we're not allowed it in fiction. And of course, we're allowed it in fiction if we tell it well enough. But it's a perennial topic. It comes up all the time. Should we have coincidence in fiction?
I've got a feeling that readers hope for coincidences very often. Coincidence is very significant in Dickens, isn't it? I mean, some people say it's ridiculous how many coincidences there are. But as a reader, you want those coincidences to happen because otherwise you can't see a way out for the characters very often.
Yes.
That you've identified with or that you want to know what's going to happen.
Yes, as a reader myself, yes. You like to be able to join those things up and to be shown them towards the end is actually really delightful, I think, because it kind of makes the thing real. It makes the thing that you've absorbed so much, you've invested so much of your life in reading the last few days, it makes it, things come together, things, is a nice thing, I think.
What about Silver and Salt, then? How does that follow on from Every Contact, your previous?
Silver and Salt, the kind of coincidental thing that happened that made me write it was that the contract that came for Every Contact Leaves a Trace came as a two-book contract, but I didn't have a second book, so I went back to an old short story I'd written a long time before that I had always dreamt of one day turning into a novel. And it was actually a comic short story about two children going on holiday in Greece and a series of things happening. Silver and Salt is very definitely not comic at all. In fact, I'm not sure anything remotely funny happens in Silver and Salt. It's kind of a much more serious version of the same story, but it's two children in an olive grove So it came because every contact had come into existence and I was in a situation where I needed to produce a second book synopsis for a publisher to decide whether they wanted to go ahead with the contract. And I think that's something I quite like, the idea of those kind of pressures on art, or those kind, not pressures, but kind of situations giving rise to... So Henry and Boo Boo I only did because I was asked to do it. I really wanted to, and it was an amazing experience, but it was because it was commissioned. I think the idea of a kind of commissioned work of art is a really interesting notion, where some other things happen. You're given a deadline, you're given a word limit, you're given...
A subject matter sometimes.
A subject, yeah. Well, yeah, in the Henry Boo Boo, it was a myth, and I'd been thinking about all this stuff, but I didn't know what I was going to do with it. And then suddenly you're given a kind of a... It's a really great thing.
People imagine that it's a bolt of inspirational lightning that creates a work of fiction, but it's not true at all, is it? It's, as you say, it's much more to do with the circumstances that you're in, and often the coincidences which happen at the same time. That you make certain decisions.
Yeah.
Some decisions are made for you, and the result is a strange alchemy.
Yes, so you have all this stuff, this free-floating stuff, the free-floating ideas and creativity or investigative drives that make you good. But then something else happens that means that it is kind of crystallised. It becomes real. It becomes something that has to be handed in on a certain date. And I think of it as being whatever is happening at that time, at that moment, that's what gets pressed into the work of art or the piece of writing. And if it had happened a month later or 3 years later or 2 years earlier, it would have been something completely different.
That was Eleanor Dimott in conversation with Robin Blake. You can find out more about Eleanor on her website at eleanordimott.com. That's Eleanor spelt E-L-A-N-O-R and Dimott with two T's. And that concludes episode 214, which was recorded by Robin Blake and produced by Conor McPhee. Coming up in episode 215, Laura Hurd speaks with Jeff Hattersley about her beginnings as a writer of bleak and gritty short stories, the real reason her first novel was written in four different voices, and how she gave her mother a literary afterlife in Dear Laura. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.